Hello, everyone, and welcome to Talk Nerdy. Today is Monday, November 28th, 2022, and I'm the host of the show, Cara Santa Maria. And I just want to tell all of you how grateful I am for your support of the show. I'm actually recording this intro a little bit in advance because I wanted to take a whole week off to celebrate Thanksgiving with my friends, my chosen family. And so I wanted to get all of this work done up front so that you had a seamless listening experience. So because of that, I'm not going to give a direct shout out to any of my patrons this week because I'm not sure who exactly they'll be. But I do want to let everyone know that I am so very grateful for your support. I'm grateful for you listening to the show, sharing the show with your friends and family, rating and reviewing the show on Apple Podcasts or Google Podcasts or wherever you download it. And of course, I'm super grateful to the patrons who continue to support the show financially. It's because of you that we've been able to keep going strong now on episode 433. I can't even believe it. So I don't want to spend too much time here at the top. Those of you here in the States or in countries that I think a little bit tongue-in-cheek celebrate this American holiday of Thanksgiving, I hope that you guys had a wonderful one and that sadly now you're ready to go back to work. We're going to go back to work today. We're going to talk to a super interesting woman who is actually recommended by a listener of the show. And I love that. Her name is Kimberly Perkins, and she is a pilot. She's actually a captain on a Gulfstream 650. She's piloted jet aircraft across six continents. She lived on three continents, and she's flown both in sort of commercial aviation and in business aviation. But she's also a PhD student at the University of Washington, and her doctoral research is on enhancement of aviation safety systems using cognitive and behavioral science. So we're really going to talk about this intersection between flying, safety, and all of the psychological components, the power dynamics, the biases that go into that. It's a fascinating chat, and I thank you guys for being here with us. So without any further ado, here she is, Kimberly Perkins. Kimberly, thank you so much for joining me today. Do you go by Kimberly or Kim?
You know, both. So you it right. So that's perfect.
We'll switch it up. We'll keep you on your toes. I'm always so excited to be able to have conversations with individuals that were recommended by listeners because A, it reminds me that people are actually listening to the show and it's not just me talking to myself. And B, like, I know that this is what people want to hear. So someone, I don't know who, saw you give a presentation and was so interested in the sort of research topics that you were discussing that they were like, you have to have her on the show. And I'm super interested too. So now here you are. Thank you.
Well, thank you for having me, and what an honor. So thank you to the guest that recommended me. I appreciate that.
So do we. Yeah, for sure. So they, I guess this person is either like a pilot or they work in an airline, and they were really interested in, I guess the overarching summary that they gave of what you were discussing in your talk was that you were researching how cognitive bias and sort of the culture of the on-air dynamic actually affects safety. And so I want to take a big step back away from safety, away from bias first, and just talk about you for a second, as you are a pilot. You are also a PhD student, but you were a pilot first, right?
Yes, I've been a pilot for many, many years. I started kind of my journey as a flight instructor, and then I went to the regional airlines for a bit, and then I switched into business aviation, so flying a corporate jet. And that's what I've been doing for the corporate jet stuff for the last 12 years.
Oh, wow. So how busy, like, I don't even know how you can really, I'm sure you can quantify, you probably have to log this stuff, but like, in terms of your day-to-day, it's probably a bit different now that you decided to go back to school and, you know, kind of dedicate a lot of your time to these academic pursuits. But how many hours, I don't know, a week, a month, like how much time are you in the air?
Yeah, so that's a good question. It's really different than the airline world. You know, so at the airlines, you're flying multiple legs a day, 4-day trips. And at the end of the year, you might have flown 800 hours. And And in corporate flying, because I fly high net worth individuals, I might fly somewhere. I might be gone for 10 days, but I might only be doing two legs in those 10 days.
Right, so I'm lucky want to you get, to be the pilot. So you're like waiting to return them or you're doing something else while you're there. Gotcha.
Exactly. So I might be lucky to get, you know, 250 hours at the end of the year. So big difference in total flight time. There's actually a lot of differences between kind of airline and corporate or business aviation flying. Both great, both have a lot of positives, both have a lot of challenges in different ways.
But and yes, you've worked in both, right?
I have, yeah. I started at the airlines, at the regional airlines. So I was flying CRJ-200s based in Philadelphia for Air Wisconsin, but it was painted, all the airplanes were painted in US Airways Express. So you would have bought a ticket on US Airways. And if you did some of that regional flying, that would have been me.
Oh, interesting.
Back in 2006 until the financial crisis in 2008.
Okay, so when you first started flying, was it like, I want to be a pilot, I want to do this professionally, I'm going to learn how to do it, I'm going to go through the motion, check all the boxes, and then I'm going to get paid to fly? Or were you like, flying seems really fun, I want to learn how to fly?
Yeah, so I wasn't quite sure what I wanted to do. After high school, I actually thought I wanted to do astrophysics, and I thought that would be really cool. And I got an internship at NASA's JPL down in Pasadena, went down there, and I said, wow, this is so interesting, but totally not what I want to do full time. So I kind of floundered for a bit and looked at different colleges, and I ended up going to a college where I did my undergrad is a bachelor's of science in aviation flight operations. So I did all my flight training concurrent to all my undergrad classes. So when I graduated with a bachelor's, I also had a multi-engine and single-engine commercial pilot's license.
Oh, smart. So you were ready to go. It was job training and it was academic training.
Yeah, smart, except for the price tag afterwards. So it was pretty pricey. And back then, so we're talking about, let's see, I graduated in 04 from college.
Same. I think we're the same age. Love this.
Yeah. Yay.
Yay.
Similar paths. And then I became, a lot of times what people do is if you're not in the military back then, you would go and be a flight instructor. And that's the best way to gain a lot of hours because you're flying with new students and I get to log those hours and I'm being paid to do it. And so by being paid, I mean like, you know, I think I made $15,000 my first year as a flight instructor. So still below the poverty line. And then I went to the regional airlines, which was great. I was really excited about that. And that also was not very much pay back then. And then I was pretty close to upgrading from first officer to captain. And then 2008 hit, that financial crisis. And then my airline, like many other airlines, started furloughing. Now, I was senior enough as a first officer that I wasn't going to be furloughed, but my upgrade to captain kind of went from a matter of months to indefinitely never. And so I took a voluntary furlough and I switched to an international airline where I was based in Lagos, Nigeria. So I flew all around West Africa for a couple of years.
Oh, very cool.
Yeah. So that was very, that was great. That is something that's wonderful to do in your 20s. And I traveled all over the world. I was based in Lagos and I lived there for 2 months and then I would have 1 month off. And I did this for 2 years. And then, so a lot of people would go home on that 1 month off, but I just kind of traveled around the world, lived in a camper van in Europe for 1 month, went down to South Africa, all over North Africa, kind of explored. And then I really wanted to break into business aviation. So I applied for a job out of Kuala Lumpur, Malaysia that I got. It was an aircraft registered in the United States, so they needed pilots who had the United States pilot's license. And that was great. That was a one-year contract. So then I switched from West Africa airline flying to Southeast Asia business aviation flying. And that was a lot of fun.
Wow. And so at what point did you decide, I think I want to start to understand a little bit more from an academic perspective of what's going on both within and without the plane? Like I want to go back to school.
Yeah. So it's a good question because I'm not your typical PhD student, right? I'm a lot older and I was, you know, I've been very, I feel very fortunate, very privileged, successful in my career, doing well. And so I didn't do the PhD. I didn't, in, you know, start this PhD program to advance my career. I did it really because I was like, all right, I love this industry, but there are some issues. And I kind of use a metaphor for hiking. I'm a huge hiker, a big love being outdoors. And you know that the kind of concept of, you know, leave it better than you found it, you know, whatever rubbish you bring in, you bring it out. So leave the nature better than you found it. And I feel the same way about the industry. So how can I leave this industry better than I found it? And that's kind of what motivated me to do the PhD research. And I'll tell you, so, and I don't want to like dive into the, like a whole statistical analysis here with you, but I will tell you, being a female pilot, there's not a lot of us out there. So there's different tiers of pilot's license. And so the top pilot license is called the airline transport pilot license. And and so you need that to fly for the airlines. You need that to be a captain, you know, in business aviation. So I argue that like most professional career pilots have to have an airline transport pilot license. And so of that, it's only 4.6 are women. The rest are men, right? It's also, so there aren't a lot of women out there. There's another study that was recently done. The FAA, so the Federal Aviation Administration, there was a Women in Aviation Advisory Board that recommended, you know, hey, there's a problem here. There aren't a lot of women, despite we've kind of been recruiting women to come into the industry for decades and decades, and these percentages haven't been changing. It's about 1% change per decade. So at that rate, I think we have like gender parity in about 450 years, and I don't think aviation is going to look the same in 450 yeah. years.
Wow. And, oh my gosh.
And so in their report, they said that airline captains, female captains, make up just 1.6%. So 1.6%. So there's a, yeah. So despite this industry being open to women, like I said, for decades, and we have a lot of wonderful social organizations, like there's, you know, Women in Aviation International, Women in Corporate Aviation, the International Aviation Women's Association, wonderful organizations doing great stuff with mentoring and scholarships. But they've been around for a while and we're not really seeing a major change. And so that was kind of one thing where I was like, gosh, there's got to be something here. What's happening here? We have people advocating for women and women aren't showing up, right? I actually looked at the U.S. Bureau of Labor Statistics looks at gender across like 383 different occupations, and all of them, except for seven, have a higher gender parity than women captains. And I was like, well, okay, so something's up here. So that was one thing that kind of got me interested in like, why is this happening? And then also I noticed that, so in the 70s, there were a series of accidents that occurred. And NASA had developed this, it's called cockpit resource management. The FAA finally ended up getting it, and it's now called crew resource management. But basically what it is it's this safety system or a safety model about how you're supposed to you know, collaborate. It was supposed to originally kind of impact this power dynamics between the captain and the first officer and get people to speak up regarding safety concerns and like clear, unambiguous communication in the flight deck, and also using all available resources. So meaning like the flight attendants, the dispatchers, back then it would be the flight engineers as well. And I started to notice when I was looking at some of the women in aviation statistics and really kind of doing some interviewing and also just like kind of casual conversations with other female pilots, noticing that there is maybe a microculture in the flight deck that doesn't feel inclusive or doesn't feel psychologically safe. And maybe that's impacting speaking up. But then, you know, the more I dug into this microculture of the flight deck and this concept of psychological safety, I saw that it's impacting lots of other people. So it's not gender specific. There aren't necessarily like all demographics are influenced by psychological safety. And these models, these systems that we rely on in the flight deck for speaking up, they start to lose their efficacy because we're not focusing on these like interpersonal skills on how do we actually communicate to unique individuals, right? There's impersonal communication, which is easy. That's checklist reading. But how do we do this interpersonal communication, which happens all the time because you're stuck like, you know, 18 inches away from this other person sometimes for 10 hours at a time on these long haul flights. I totally detoured off your original question. I'm sorry.
No, you didn't, because this is like actually the point of all of this, right? Like this is the meat, and this is what's so incredibly interesting. So ultimately, I'm curious, like obviously you're working towards a PhD for those who have been lucky/unlucky, lucky enough to pursue a graduate degree that's like very research focused. Then you know that there's like coursework and there's all this stuff that you have to do, but it all culminates in a dissertation. So what is your actual main sort of research question that you're focused on right now?
Yeah. So as you mentioned, I'm a PhD student. So I still get that liberty of saying like, oh, I want to look at this and I want to research this and how about that? And then as you know, because you're a PhD candidate, you start to like that slice of the pie that you want to research starts getting smaller and smaller and smaller until it's like so fine tuned and exactly what you want to look at. So the first kind of part that I was looking at is, does this impact of perception of getting along with the other pilot you're flying with, is this impacting your ability to speak up? So that was kind of the first thing that I was looking at. And I will specifically answer your question, but let me give you kind of like paint the story of how I got there. So there have been other academic research, researchers who looked at kind of power dynamics and power distance in the flight deck, right? And how in certain national cultures where there's a high power distance, then first officers are less likely to speak up regarding safety concerns, right? And that's great. That's really interesting. But I kind of wanted to look at more of just this perception of getting along, right? Okay. Do you get along with the other pilot? So strip away the institutional hierarchy here from captain versus first officer.
Okay. Yeah. Okay.
Okay. So when we're talking about this crew resource management, the safety model for speaking up, which all pilots globally are trained on this. This is kind of like the gold standard for training pilots on how to talk to each other. And so the first thing that I wanted to look at is, so this clear, unambiguous communication. So we'll label that as safety voice. So that's speaking up regarding a safety concern. So safety voice would say, you know, maybe let's say the captain's flying and the first officer looks at this thunderstorm right at 12 o'clock, right ahead, and says, hey, you have a thunderstorm 12 o'clock, which way do you want to turn, left or right, you know? And that would be kind of an example of this clear, unambiguous communication.
But okay. Put a pin in that for a second, because I have a quick question for you.
Sure.
How many people, and maybe this is something we're taking for granted, because I honestly have no idea. How many people are, like, first of all, the flight deck, is that the cockpit? Is that the same thing?
And it is the same thing. Yes.
Okay. And how many people are usually in there?
Two.
So it's always two?
Not always. So So sometimes there's three for long haul flights. You know, sometimes you have on such a long flight, you might have two people up front, and then you have two other people who are in the back, and they'll come up and like a relief pilot. Occasionally there's three. On majority of the flights, a large majority, there's two people. So it's the captain and the first officer, and usually, so how it works. Thank you for making me rewind. So how it works.
Yeah, no, of course. I'm like, because most people don't get to see through those thick doors. Like, we don't know what's up there.
It's so funny because I'm like, everybody is a pilot. You know, I just assume everybody already knows what I know. And so like,
you know,
it's funny because, yeah, totally, right? I mean, I have my little lens of the world and I just assume everybody, you know, flies airplanes too, right? This is a thing.
Right, totally. Yeah.
So again, this is where like the corporate world and the airline world kind of diverge a little bit. But so I'm going to focus kind of answer a lot of the work because there's a lot more airline pilots than there are corporate pilots. So in the airline world, how it works is the captain will sit in the left seat and the first officer will sit in the right seat and they'll trade off who does the flying. So the captain isn't always the one flying. And so I you'll find a lot of pilots have a pet peeve of when they say, oh, the pilot and the co-pilot. It's like, okay, well, everybody's a pilot. We're all flying the airplane at different times, right? But it's so captain and first officer. And so there's this institutional hierarchy, right? So the captain has more institutional power than the first officer in the right seat. And so crew resource management is meant to kind of lower that the power dynamics so that first officers are, they're required, they're compelled to speak up regarding safety concerns, right? And so this is that activating safety voice. So kind of circling back to what I was saying, there's this expectation that they're going to speak up, right? That's what you would want. You have two people up there. And if the captain's doing something that might seem questionable, the first officer is fully capable of taking controls and flying the airplane and making decisions, right? A lot of times, especially now because there's such a pilot shortage, the only difference between who's in the captain and who's a first officer might not even be experience. It might be who's been at the airline longer, because it's all kind of based on who's been at. So somebody could be a captain at, let's say, United for 20 years. And if they decide, oh gosh, I want to move my family to Atlanta, so I'm going to go to Delta, and they decide to go to Delta, they lose that captain position and they become a first officer at Delta, right?
So even though they might have, they have more institutional experience, they don't have as much experience at that one airline.
Right. And yeah, right. So a lot of times it's based on how long you've been at that particular airline. So my research was looking at, okay, so we have this expectation, this crew resource management. And then eventually there was another model that came out in the 90s called threat and error management. And it was kind of integrated in with crew resource management. And so it's this expectation that we're going to identify threats, and we're going to, mitigate some of the human error by trapping it and putting these models in place. And it has this expectation that the microculture of the flight deck is this kind of inclusive environment where everybody feels comfortable speaking up. And what I found, so my first research question was, well, is this happening?
Right. That seems like a kind of a big assumption, no?
It's a huge assumption. It's a total huge assumption. And I mean, I don't think you'll be shocked to know that, yeah, when people don't get along in the flight deck, we start to see this transition from activating safety voice to what we would call muted safety voice. So now they might be speaking up, but in a kind of like hushed, or maybe they'll ask a question. So it's not this clear, unambiguous communication anymore. It's muted, right? And then in like even worse situation is the safety silence. So this is where pilots might feel so uncomfortable to speak up, or they want to save face, or whatnot, that they're sitting on safety sensitive information and they're not speaking up at all. And so that's originally kind of what my research was looking at, is how is this microculture? Because let me also tell you, so how the FAA works, the Federal Aviation Administration, is we often say that regulations are written in blood. And I know that sounds bad, but basically bad stuff happens. They make a regulation to fix it, right? And that's what we all have to abide by, these regulations. But then what happens is the FAA and often industry leaders will come together in a rulemaking committee, and they come up with what's called an advisory circular. And what that is that's like, hey, here's a way to comply with the regulation. It's one means of compliance, right? And it's often really good stuff. So in 2004, they came out with this crew resource management training advisory circular. And I went through it, and there's really great stuff in there. There's stuff that would, really impact the interpersonal skills of pilots. For example, there's stuff in there about external influences on interpersonal communication and definitions of and or solutions for interpersonal communication barriers such as rank, age, and gender. These are things that the FAA suggested pilots train. And I thought, wow, there's like a lot of really good stuff in here. So now my second research question was like, are pilots being trained on this? Like, do pilots think that they're being trained on these interpersonal skills? And so I did kind of an industry benchmarking, and I went out and asked pilots who were flying for air carriers here in the United States, which if you're flying for an air carrier in the US, it's mandated by the FAA that you do crew resource management training. So I used the verbiage from the advisory circular and just said, hey, have you been trained on these things? I was shocked to find that like some of these topics, 48% of the pilots said, yeah, I've done that. 56% said that they've done training around remaining calm under stressful conditions, right? So there was like a huge training gap. And I looked at, so what I did is I looked at 15 different facets from the advisory circular that came out 18 years ago. And then I quantified the number of pilots who had said that they had received this training first to kind of identify, okay, there's a training gap here. So we said like, it's kind of that it's built on a big assumption, yes, but the FAA offered guidance on here's what you could be training to create an inclusive environment. And then I said, okay, well, let's see, is this actually being trained? And I found that it's kind of not being trained.
So it was guidance, but it wasn't like, it was a recommendation, not a requirement.
Yeah, unfortunately, that's how it's set up. So the requirement All right. is that you have to do crew resource management training. So I could be at one airline and have, we're going to call it CRM. So the whole industry calls it CRM, crew resource management. So one airline might have CRM training that teaches a particular skill set. It's kind of based on who developed the CRM training module. And then I go to a different airline and I do a different type of CRM training. Now, the FAA has to kind of sign you off saying, yep, you have a CRM training program, but it doesn't mean you have to cover all of their suggested recommendations. So one, I was trying to look at, like, measure, is there a training gap? But kind of more important to me as far as a behavioral scientist or social psychologist is there a buy-in gap? Do pilots think that these interpersonal skills, that setting the correct tone and the microculture of the flight deck, is this relevant to safety? So is there a buy-in from the users of the system that these, you know, getting along and creating psychological safety, is this important? So that's also where my research went, is looking at, is there a kind of a buy-in gap? So I was telling you about how, sorry, go ahead.
I was just like, it has so much face validity. Like it's probably very clear to you and me as people who like kind of work in and read a lot of psychology literature and think about sort of dynamics and working dynamics. Like it has a lot of face validity, right? That a pilot would know that if I get along with the people that I'm working with and I feel safe around them, that I'm more likely to speak up when something is potentially dangerous. But does that only have face validity from the outside? Are you starting to see that pilots themselves feel, I don't know if you can give away any of the research that you've already started to collect, but that pilots themselves do feel that way? Or do you find like a gap, like that they are lacking buy-in?
Yeah, so good question. I'm super happy to share some of this with you.
Okay.
There's a training gap and there is a slight buy-in gap. And then that will lead me down the path of talking about, well, who doesn't think this is important? And before I like dive into that, let me tell you, So I told you, you know, the regulations are kind of written in blood, right? So we had crew resource management came out after a series of really bad accidents in the 70s. Well, there were a series of bad accidents that happened in the early 2000s with Colgan kind of being the most popular one. And NTSB determined that there was a common denominator amongst all of these crashes. And now this is relatively recent, right? This is the early 2000s. And it was this unprofessional behavior. So human error, right? And so what came out of that is the FAA said, okay, now all airline pilots, you're going to have to do, if you're a pilot in command, so if you're a captain, you have to do this leadership and command training. And oh, by the way, you also have to do a mentoring program for first officers. And it has to be done and implemented by April of 2023, so next year. And again, unfortunately, it's not like, they don't have enough teeth in the system because of how our government is set up to say like, this is exactly how it has to look like. They just say, here's what you have to do, go forth and do it, right? But the people who are designing this program, they're not behavioral scientists, they're not social psychologists, right? And so let me tell you some of the research that I did. So first and foremost, I think most pilots would say, okay, well, captains set the tone. Like in the flight deck, captains are the ones who are kind of setting the tone in the flight deck. And I wanted to
right,
say,
because
okay,
they have more like that, like because they have the most senior, well, maybe, whatever you want to call it, they have the most power.
Yeah. And you know what? The FAA says, hey, you're supposed to. The pilot in command, right. So the captains
There's
are supposed to set
a
the
chain
tone.
Of command. Yeah.
Exactly.
That makes sense.
And
Yeah.
But I wanted to say, like, okay, do we all think that? Is this just another assumption? I asked 822 industry pilots, and I said, you know, do you think first officers are compelled to adapt to the culture style established by the captain? Well, 93% said yes, either sometimes or all the time. So I think it's fair to say that is a huge majority that yes, captains are setting the tone. So then I wanted to look at how are pilots shifting from this activating safety voice to muted safety voice to safety silence. And so I asked, hey, thinking about a time when you were a first officer or your current role as a first officer, has it ever happened to you, or give, you know, how many times on an average year have you hesitated at speaking up regarding safety because of this tone established by the captain? So we already know, kind of overwhelmingly, captains are setting the tone. So now that within this tone that they're setting, how is this impacting first officers' ability to activate safety voice? And what I was really surprised is 75% of first officers said, oh yeah, every year I hesitate speaking up regarding safety because of something that the captain did or said in the flight deck. So this microculture, this tone. Here's what's scarier. So I then kind of upped the severity to the safety silence. 57% of first officers said, oh yeah, I felt silenced after bringing up a safety concern. So like they tried to activate safety voice, and then because of the tone established by the captain, something that the captain did or said, they felt silenced. So they decided no longer to share their safety sensitive information. So they went to, yeah. So this whole model was kind of built on the assumption that the flight deck is an inclusive environment, right? And we're really relying on these models because human error, so we're never going to eradicate human error, as we know, but we can put these models and systems in place to mitigate some of the harmful impacts of human error. But we're still seeing, so in 2007, the FAA came out with this white paper and basically said that of all the airplane accidents, 60 to 80% of them are caused because of human error. So it's not mechanical error per se that overwhelmingly causing airplanes to crash. It's human error. And so, but yet we have these systems almost every decade since the 70s, we saw like a new aviation safety model put into place. We had aeronautical decision-making and we had safety management system, which is more organizational safety. But my point here is that some of these systems are built on the assumption that there's this psychological safety. And I feel like that's an important term to talk about. Some people think like, oh, it's a new trendy term, and it's not. It's been around since the 60s. But as you know, it became really popular in 1999 with Dr. Amy Edmondson, who was looking at the medical industry. And she defined psychological safety as this team condition that is like safe for interpersonal risk-taking. So meaning you're able to admit your mistakes, ask for help, right? Learn from failure. So that's the concept of psychological safety. And that's what you need in the flight deck. And so CRM was built on this assumption of psychological safety. And
what's CRM? Sorry, why am I not knowing that?
The crew resource, acronym? No, because crew resource management, crew resource
gotcha.
Management.
Gotcha.
Yeah. No worries, yeah. And one thing about aviation
is
I
was listening. I'm so bad with acronyms.
No, and our industry is all acronyms. Oh my goodness. You could have an entire conversation on, oh, there are ATP holders learning CRM and TEM, and like you could just go down a whole acronym path.
Yeah. So it's clinical psychology. It's the worst. It's like, I have no idea what anybody's ever talking about. Okay. So crew management safety, it's all sort of like based on these assumptions, and these assumptions, it turns out, are not holding a lot of water.
Yeah. So I've found that, you know, there is a training gap, right? And then I wanted to look at how is just the perception of getting along. So removing the hierarchy. I didn't want to just focus on, you know, captains versus first officers, because most captains are like, I want to set a good tone. I think the majority of captains are well-intentioned, thinking that they are setting the right tone. But they were not trained in social psychology. They were not trained on how to have interpersonal communications, but they're expected to be able to do it, right? So now they're having to set the tone, but they haven't really had like, how do you manage people training? And so I wanted to also look at, so how is this level of psychological safety impacting regardless of this hierarchy? So I asked again, a series of industry pilots here in the US. And I just asked questions like, okay, when you get along with the other pilot you're flying with, do you strongly agree? I use that Likert scale, you know, like you strongly agree, neither agree or disagree, and kind of downwards. I asked, do you strongly agree? Are you able to admit your mistakes? Ask for help. Feel like a valued team member. And then I did the same series of questions with the perception of not getting along in the flight deck. And I wanted to look at that delta, that variance of getting along versus not getting along. And you know what's crazy is there's a huge impact. So there was over a 50% impact on being able to admit mistakes or ask for help just in the perception of getting along, and over a 61% negative impact of feeling like a valued team member. And I asked those particular questions because those are kind of little facets into psychological safety, feeling valued as a team member, right? Asking for help, admitting mistakes. And so that started the research questions of like, okay, so what's happening here? Why, you know, captains are setting the tone, but they're not really given sufficient tools on how do you set the right tone? How do you know that you've created a psychologically safe microculture in the flight deck? And so then I wanted to look at, so then it leads me back to like kind of this buy-in, which you had asked me about, like, is there a buy-in gap? And so one of the things that, remember I mentioned the advisory circular on crew resource management training 18 years ago, and in there they talk, the FAA says, hey, you know, part of good crew resource management is being able to demonstrate your understanding of the usefulness of showing sensitivity towards other crew members' personalities and styles. So basically like, hey, see the other person as a unique individual, adapt your leadership traits to them, you know, see other people as unique individuals. So I asked industry pilots, I asked 810, and I said, hey, have you had to do this as part of CRM training? And 51% said, no, I don't know what you're talking about. So
they hadn't even heard of it.
Right. They're like, nope, haven't had to do that. So that measures potentially a training gap. But then I wanted to measure, okay, well, do people think this is important? And so I said, well, in your opinion, would safety be enhanced if you had to do this, right? Again, remember, I'm using the exact verbiage from the FAA. So the FAA already said, hey, this is important for safety. And so then I just asked pilots, hey, do you think this is important for safety? And 85% said yes or maybe. I think it was like, I don't have the stats right in front of me, but I think it was like, you know, 50% said yes. And
wait, you're telling me all of these findings from memory? I'm so impressed right now.
I've given a lot of presentations recently, so I'm sorry if I'm in presentation mode.
It's incredible. I'm like, how do you know this off the top of your head? All right, sorry. Anyway.
Well, it's you know, it's when it's your own research, it's easier to memorize all of these stats.
True. Because you're the one who like had to analyze all the data. But so basically, like most people get it intuitively. They're like, yeah, that's important. Of course it's important. I wish I would have learned
it's important. Right. And that's what I mean. I think there's already a really high buy-in. There's just not enough training around the tools on developing a psychologically safe microculture. And how could there be? Because the people who are developing the CRM training programs are not behavioral scientists. They're not social psychologists. They haven't been given the tools for like, how do you really train this? But I did want to look at like, so 15% said, nah, I don't need this. I'm good. I don't need this sensitivity training. I don't need the interpersonal skills. So right. And here's where it gets kind of interesting is I started thinking, okay, well, who says, nah, I'm good. I don't need this. And I was really looking at power. And there's so many different definitions for power, but I like the one from Dolly Chugg's book where she talks about power is just having any control over outcomes or resources. And so I wanted to look at, okay, who has institutional power? And who has social power? So institutional power, we kind of already talked about that hierarchy, captain and first officer. So I wanted to use that as a variable for who says, nah, I'm good. I don't need this interpersonal skills stuff. And then for social power, remember I mentioned to you that the demographics on gender, where it's, you know, about 95% male and maybe 5% women.
That's something that sort of, I feel like we need to really dig into and specify here, because a lot of this data up to this point that you've been talking about has to do with psychological safety, has to do with comfort, has to do with, am I trained in these areas? Is this something that I think matters? And it's been, I mean, tell me if I'm wrong, but it sounds like it's been agnostic of intersectionality. Like, we're just asking all people in the flight deck how they feel about this. But of course, race, gender, socioeconomic status, language of origin, like these things are going to be like intervening variables. How could they not be?
Right. Yeah, absolutely. And so, and I, gosh, we could have an entire podcast just diving into that. But let me tell you, when I looked at who said, nah, I'm good on the culture stuff.
Were they cishet men? Were they white?
Well, I'll tell you that captains were more likely than first officers to say, we don't need this. And men were...
Jeez.
Yeah. And men were more than double than women saying, nah, we don't need this. So it's those who hold the power, right? Whether it's institutional power or social power. Those in power tend to have a harder time seeing the importance of this interpersonal skills.
And, which again, it's those who need it the most who think they don't need it.
Right. Exactly. That's so frustrating. And here's what's really kind of I don't want to say scary, but here's something that I think is important to recognize is there is a massive pilot shortage, right? And so there's all these wonderful programs out there to get people into the industry and to diversify, right? United Airlines has awesome goals about their Aviate program, which is a pilot training program, really focusing on diversity. And I think it's awesome. I think it's so great. But when we shift the massive demographics, like right now, if you look at airline transport pilot license holders, I told you it's 95% men, but I didn't tell you it's 94% white. So,
So
there is a very strong, and you know how many LGBTQ plus people we have? We don't know because nobody asked. It's not something the FAA records right now, unfortunately.
Even if they did ask, I would be concerned about how safe some people would feel to answer honestly.
Yeah.
Like
yeah,
even among those white men, how many of those like white men are gay white men? Like they may not even feel safe to say.
Right. And here's the thing that hasn't gone over really well, I don't think, is when we do traditional like bias training or bias literacy, unfortunately, the world has created a lot of bias training now, right? It's been a hot topic, and I think it's important, but it's done in a way where we talk about power and privilege, and we tend to create this like them versus us. And I really don't think that that is productive. I think that cisgendered, straight, white men can also feel low psychological safety in the flight deck, right? So I'm not trying to create an us versus them scenario. And so I think we would be better of like modeling inclusivity as we train how to be inclusive, right? By bringing everybody to the table. And so that's one of the big things that I've been trying to do. And so that's kind of what some of my latest research has been about is like, how can we talk about bias literacy, psychological safety, interpersonal communication in a way that feels really safe to those that might not think this is important, right? How can we reach them? And so talking about these concepts through a safety framework, because as pilots, we focus, I mean, what is number one in aviation? Safety. And so when we talk about bias literacy through a safety framework, we're really modeling inclusion here, right? Because we're bringing everybody to the table. We're not creating a them versus us. We're not, and you know, studying psychology, humans, we are like social animals and we are really, we have a propensity to create these in-groups, out-groups. And part of this bias literacy that I was training pilots on is talking about in-group and out-group. And it's really arbitrary who we put in our in-group, right? It can, in when we're talking about the flight deck, it could be military versus not military. It could be, dog people, cat people. It could be sports fans, not sports fan. But sometimes it can be across gender, race, ethnicity, sexual orientation, right? It can be across these other kind of heavier lines.
Worrisome thing too is that like there are these, I don't want to call them arbitrary because you're right. When you're talking about the dynamics of a dyad or a triad, there are all sorts of places where people can find common ground, and there are all sorts of places where people can say, you're too different from me to get along. Religion, you know, you mentioned a lot of them. But unfortunately, number one, there are some things that are expressive that you can't hide, because it's like your skin color or like your gender. Like it's that's how you present to the world. And then there's this question that I think is so important here, which is like, if only 5% of you or 1% of you are women, are you ever going to be able to get around feeling safe, like fully safe, simply because you're never, ever, or you're so rarely going to find yourself in a situation where there are others like you making up the dyad or the triad?
Right. Yeah. And that's a good point. And it's funny because I'm a mixed method researcher. So I have a lot of quantitative data, but I also have a lot of qualitative. And in the qualitative work, one of the things that kept kind of reoccurring were female pilots saying, I'm a pilot first and a woman second.
Mm-hmm. And yeah. But how much of that is like protective, you know, also 100%. Like,
and yeah. Let's be honest, I mean, stereotype threat. The other problem is I'll tell you, I mean, I have a lot of my own personal stories, but I have, even just recently, I just did a flight where I flew with a guy. I mean, I'm talking about like 3 days ago, and I was the first female pilot he's ever flown with. And This happens often. And also when
you mean like
airlines.
you mean like you were flying around like a rich dude, like somebody hired you and he was like, wow, you're the first chick who's ever been behind the wheel.
Well, that's true. But also, no, the other pilot who was in the flight deck with me said he's never flown with a female before.
Wow. Okay.
So it's still happening. Like this isn't something that happened, you know, with our mothers in the, you know, feminist movement. This is happening right now where people, women, and then unfortunately, we start to stereotype, right? So I've had men say to me like, oh, wow, you actually do fly a good airplane, or you fly just as good as the guys. And you're like, oh my gosh.
They assume you can't because there aren't any of you. Like that. And it's like, there's to some extent, it's like, do you blame somebody for developing that kind of stereotype? It's like chiseled into their brain. I mean, it's not okay, but people do start to go like, why is it only 1%? And they don't think, oh, because there are barriers. They're literally like deep institutional barriers. They think it must be because women aren't good at it or women don't like it. Like the faster place for them to go psychologically, which is so sad.
It is sad. And I've heard that so many times too, is like, oh, women just aren't interested. And remember I mentioned to you earlier in this podcast is that I looked at all of the gender data on like 383 different occupations in the United States. And statistically speaking, there are more women astrophysicists, more women astronauts, more women long-haul truck drivers, and more women paleontologists. So I say somehow as a society, we have made rockets and trucks and dinosaurs more gender neutral than airplanes. Why? And that the FAA Women in Aviation Advisory Board came out with a really great, wonderful report this past March. And they said the number one biggest barrier for women in aviation is a negative culture.
Yeah. So why would you want to walk into basically a men's locker room and be like, I'm comfortable here and I'm safe here? And that's not to say that, you know, it's that bad, but if there has historically always been maybe it's a different kind of psychological safety, a psychological privilege of, oh, we don't have to watch our mouths because there's never women around. Like, that's sad.
Yeah. And there is, here's the thing is, I think that we need to focus on changing the system. So a lot of times we talk about bias training as like this individual should do better. And I think that we need to focus on the systemic change. Because so I've written an academic paper, but also some aviation papers. And I had this one aviation lawyer reach out to me and he said, hey, I'm an ally and I want to co-author a paper about how women aren't inclusive. I try to be a good ally and women are not making me feel comfortable. And I said, oh my gosh, that's so horrible. I will definitely write this if that's what's happening. So let me just do some more research and make sure that that's really what, you know, that's your experience, that's your lived experience. Great. But let me just gather some data. So I polled 582 industry pilots. And it was a very simple poll, right? And we can get into like, this is not rigorous academic research, a poll. There's a lot of like bias, inherent bias probably in just the way that the poll was conducted. But basically, I said, hey, here's the gender imbalance. And I gave the percentages. And oh, by the way, you know, women student pilots make up 14.2%, but as captains, less than, they're at like 1.6%. So even when we get them into the industry, we're losing them.
Right, that happens in every industry. It's so infuriating.
Anyway. Right. So I asked these 582 men, I said, hey, regarding this gender imbalance, you know, are you actively doing something about it, right? Are you an ally? Do you, you know, are you not doing anything because you don't know how to help? Are you not doing anything because you don't feel comfortable helping, which is what this one particular guy's experience was? Or is it just like, this isn't your problem, you don't care? And what was really sad, 64% said, not my problem, don't care.
Like they actually, 64. Like, it's like they said the quiet part out loud on a poll. Like, I can't believe that.
On a poll.
That.
Yeah. Wow. And so I think that we have some wonderful allies out there. There are some guys doing some like really great stuff, but we have to kind of talk about it from a more systemic change. Is like, we need to, if we could train these concepts of bias literacy and psychological safety and interpersonal communication, we can make the system have to train these pilots on this to create that psychologically safe environment, which will benefit everybody. But I think those that have the most to benefit are the underrepresented cohorts in aviation, right? So, for example, if we're talking about women, I think women might have the most to gain because they're the ones who are kind of experiencing that negative culture the most. But it's not like one, it's not just one individual man's fault or problem. I mean, this is built on, this goes back to like World War II days, right? The United States government created a civilian pilot training program and said, hey, yeah, you want to be a pilot? Be a pilot. And we'll pay for it. And back then, I think there were like, I should look up these stats. Okay, there were 34,000 pilots back then. This is in 1939. So then the U.S. says, we'll pay for your pilot training. Here we go. Come in. Oh, by the way, you want to be a pilot in the pilot training? Well, just have some criteria, like be a man and also be white, right? And then at the end, by 1944, they had 435,000 new aviators. So they minted a lot of pilots, but you had to be white and you had to be male. And so that kind of like launched. Now that's a long time ago, but still we see like,
but
even
that's how
in the
you change culture. I mean, that's how you like make these massive, it's like looking back at redlining. It's like looking back at any sort of like systemic problem. It's like the reason it persists now is because there was a concerted effort then.
Yeah. Oh, absolutely. And then we've like seen academic research. Like I saw aviation academic research looking at, well, what makes a good pilot? No joke, in the 70s, I was reading some kind of when crew resource management first came out, I was looking at some of the academic research around pilot traits and characteristics, right? And it actually talked about, it painted these pilots, male pilots, as like these adventure-seeking exhibitionists. And it was just like laden with egotistical typecasts. In the academic paper, it actually talked about the phallic male. And that's how to be a good pilot.
That's the term they used? Jeez.
Phallic. Yeah, I was like, oh, this has to go in my dissertation.
Of dickishness. Yeah, that's what I'm saying.
And so you know I have to get that in my dissertation. I have to be able to write phallic somehow. and so then it was like, oh, well, women have to adopt this. And then you see it in the original Top Gun, right? What was the original Top Gun? People loved that movie, but it was this like type A, tough personality. And then we started to see research around, well, wait a second, what can women bring to the table? And we started to see things like, well, women are better collaborators and they're better communicators. And then there was academic research looking at the human errors across gender lines. So like, do female pilots make different errors or worse errors than male pilots? And I think all of that, honestly, if I'm just going to be totally honest, and here's my swear word for the day, is total bullshit. Because as soon as we start making human error and pilot error and safety around gender, we've just kind of created that them versus us. I don't think it's helpful or productive to create these masculine feminine defaults and looking at how like white men are the default and how does everybody else, you know, adapt or adjust differently around them. I think we need to say,
if everything else is non-normative, then it's going to like by definition come across as pathological. Like that's when you build the system and then you go, why aren't you acting like you're within the system? You're wrong. I mean, come on. Like this is the definition of bias.
Absolutely. And I think it's way more productive to say, look, forget about like gender traits and characteristics or defaults that we assign to a specific gender. Because first of all, a lot of the gender discussion is very binary, and I don't want to pigeonhole people into that either. But the FAA asks, are you male or are you female, unfortunately. So we have a lot of ground to break on that regard. But I think it's more important to say, okay, look, so the flight deck is a socio-technical system, meaning there's a social aspect of the people that operate, but it's inside this technology. The characteristics needed for that is good communication, collaboration, good decision-making, creating psychological safety. It doesn't have to be, these traits don't have to be assigned to a gender. But unfortunately, a lot of academic research in the past has done that. And as a society, we've done that, right? Oh, guys make better decisions. They're faster decisions. But women are better communicators. They're more nurturing. I don't think that's productive or healthy. I think we can say—
It's also completely constructed. Yeah, it's like completely 100%. Culturally bound and completely constructed. And— what it reinforces something that I was just working with some of my supervisees the other day, and one of them brought up a talk or something that she had been watching about stereotype threat, and she was kind of talking about being a Black woman, a Black non-conforming Black woman, and she was saying that this conversation about stereotype threat that we have all like really adopted because it's such an important psychological concept, right? And this idea that we unwittingly or unknowingly, or maybe wittingly and knowingly, but we walk into these spaces where we don't feel safe. And then we think, I'm going to do poorly because I've been told my whole life I'm going to do poorly. And then we end up doing poorly because that is what we expect. And she was saying, I actually think that we've been conceptualizing stereotype threat incorrectly, because we talk about it as if it's invented. We talk about it as if it's like this mentality that we have, but it's not, there is a real threat. Like if I walk into a space that was never built for me, I am going to feel like I'm not good enough because,
right. And because I don't fit here. That's some of that self-fulfilling prophecy. Yeah.
It's like this space. You look at like women astronauts who literally like couldn't fly because the spacesuits didn't fit them. You know what I mean? It's like at a certain point, we have to come up with a different word than stereotype threat, because it's literally that we're trying to adapt to something that we can't adapt to because it was never built for us in the first place. Like, yes, yeah. We're always going to fall short at being a white man because I'm not a white man.
I know. And I keep reminding some of the people in my industry, I'm like, you know, eventually we're going to run out of like straight cisgendered white men to fill all the pilot spots. So we're going to have to start talking about this, you know, in a different right. way. We're going to have right. to stop using them as the default. And
infuriating, the norm.
It is. And also, I think it's important to point out that, like, I don't think that there's no like malice or ill intent, right? If people, bias is super normal. As humans, we have tons of bias. But I think it's important to remember that this bias manifests not just cognitively, it's not just with our thoughts, right? But it impacts our affect, how we feel, but also our behavior. And so even if somebody harbors a little bit of like, you know, some stereotyping or naive realism, whatever, fundamental attribution error, you can pick any of these things, it might influence our behavior with the other person. And so that is very relevant to safety. If we're building models, safety models around this intergroup and intragroup dynamics, we should be focusing more from a social psychology standpoint of, yeah, these biases and how they're manifesting.
Agree. And I would even argue that, like, because you mentioned something and it really like stuck out to me, and I want to kind of dig into it really quickly. I know we don't have much time left, but you mentioned this idea that like bias, like very often this is not malicious, this is not intentional, this is not even conscious, right? Like bias is so pernicious, and it is so like culturally kind of prescribed that we don't even know we have. And it's like you see all the time, right? Like women have like sexist biases against women, and like, you know, individuals of color will have like racist biases against other people of the same kind of ethnic background. Like it's that pernicious. But the point that I'm trying to make is that I would almost argue that worse than the bias itself is the refusal to own it. It's the refusal to check yourself, to recognize it when it's pointed out to you, and to have the humility to say, yeah, oh, that was not okay. That's me being a human being. And how can I be a better human being now? How can I correct this behavior? But the double down, no, it wasn't me. No, reverse racism. How could you say that about me? Like that percentage of the individuals in your study who are like, I don't even need this. Like that's way scarier to me.
Right. Yeah, I know. I feel like we're still in this world of, okay, we have to raise awareness. But beyond that, we have to do training around, well, what is a growth mindset, right? How can we take responsibility? And so I actually talk about privilege and power, but without saying those words because I've found that they're triggering. And I talk about like personal headwinds and personal tailwinds. And like, how do we see
smart.
That some
I
people...
love that. That's so fun.
I borrowed that from other social psychologists. So I wish
really
I could say
smart.
I made that up. But it feels less threatening, right? But I think also I try to talk about like, what is naive realism? So we all tend to believe that we see the world as this objective reality, right? And we're all going around going, oh yeah, this is the truth. This is the truth. But really, we filter everything. I think I actually heard one of your podcasts where you were talking to someone and you were talking about positivism and how like, you know, I don't know if you are a positivist or not, but like, I don't truly believe that there's just definitive information out there and we just have to go do the finding. It's like, no, as we look and we discover, we are altering what we're seeing, right? And so that happens with our truths too. Like I see the world slightly different than somebody else. We all have these filters on.
Yeah,
and that's okay.
I'm definitely become much more of a constructivist thinker the more I study psychology.
Yes, I am too. But one of the things is I think we need to teach that to everybody is that like if we hold this is the one singular truth and, you know, then that's really harmful because then you're never going to have that growth mindset of owning your own bias. We all have these biases, explicit and implicit. But until we can also say like, yes, we acknowledge that. And here's how we can make sure that this doesn't like negatively impact how we're communicating with other people, how we're interacting with other people. And I want to do that from a systems level, right? I keep going back to the systems level. I want pilot expectation for this behaviorism. Because you don't remember like back in the day, early social psychology was like, oh, if you want to change people's behavior, you have to impact their attitudes and their beliefs. Well, now it's like, well, we can actually impact their behavior and make that the norm. And then eventually that might impact their attitude and their values. And so I want to make the behavior, the expectation for pilots to be able to operate in a crew environment is with this understanding of bias literacy, of psychological safety, of interpersonal communication. So making a systemic change. And then hopefully maybe we'll reach the individual attitudes and values eventually. But first I'm going to focus on the systems change.
I think it's smart, and I think I can't think of words today. It's sort of like you're focusing on efficacy, right? Like change the behavior first. Maybe, hopefully, some of the attitudes because we're talking about like a systems level approach. Maybe, hopefully, some of the attitudes at the individual level will change. There's always going to be those holdouts. There's always going to be those generational issues. And sorry, like those people are going to retire. They're going to die. Like that's going to eventually happen too. And if the system itself is robust enough that the new trainees who are coming in are getting these perspectives offered to them early on and they're getting molded within this model, that you're going to see slow, steady generational change instead of just trying to like convince a bunch of like old dudes with their heels dug in that they need to like use like proper pronouns. Like that might not be the way to go about it. You know what I mean? Like those people may never get it, but if they're forced to do the trainings and now the new cohort who comes in is getting all of that training and they're starting to just think in a slightly different way, I think we are going to see systemic change.
Yeah, I think we have to, because remember I mentioned earlier too about how the FA is requiring this mentoring. And I've had kind of like well-seasoned, experienced pilots with a lot of flight time, you know, been at the airline for a long time. They say, hey, I want a mentor the incoming millennials, but they have their hand up. They don't want to be mentored. It's their, you know, their problem. I try to mentor, but they don't allow it, right? They're entitled, whatever, fill in the blank stereotype. And then I talk to the incoming millennials, right? The so-called, I don't want to be mentored. And they say, no, I would love to be mentored. I would love to be mentored, but I don't want it to be done in a patronizing way. So please talk to me differently. And so we're talking about like, everybody is coming with like the like really good intent, right? But they're just having a hard time seeing that good intent from the other person. And it's because we see these things through our own biases, our own filters, and because we don't have the tool. Pilots haven't really been given the social psychology, behavioral scientist tools on how do we break through our own personal biases to see these other people, to see where they're coming from. How do we do that? And that's why I think we need that systems change. So we're absolutely going to need that in our industry.
Oh,
it's safety purposes.
Important. Yeah. I mean, it's like the downstream effects are so important, right? They're important for the psychological health, obviously, of all of the individuals involved and of the industry as a whole. But they're like arguably what's more important is that the lives of the consumers whose hands, you know, or whose lives are in their hands. Like ultimately, it's not just about these people, it's about all of the people whose lives they are touching. And that is really the goal here. And I love that you're able not just to link those two things, because it's not an arbitrary link. Like you're really showing that something as simple as how well two people get along with each other can ultimately determine whether or not, you know, a safety check is performed, whether or not, you know, a very important warning is verbalized, and ultimately who suffers when our own hubris or our own pettiness or our own unconscious biases prevent us from doing our jobs like really effectively. Well, who suffers are the people who are potentially harmed because of that.
Right. Absolutely. I mean, I think if you remember a couple months ago, it was all over the news, Alaska Airlines, two pilots got into an argument after they pushed back from the gate and they had to return to the gate and one of the pilots got off. Now, part of the training that I've been doing is talking about like when we don't feel psychologically safe, you know, unfortunately, our brains aren't as sophisticated. Our amygdala senses that threat, right? And it looks at it. It doesn't perceive really the difference between kind of a physical threat or emotional threat. It just triggers that fight, flight, or freeze response, right? And we see this happening in the flight deck. And some of my qualitative research from these semi-structured interviews I did was around pilots who have experienced low psychological safety. So somebody setting the tone had a cognitive bias, impacted the psychological safety of the team condition, the microculture in the flight deck, and that person's amygdala got triggered, right? And so they had a physiological response. Their heart started beating faster, hands got sweaty, right? Their focus got narrowed. And then you start to see that shift go from activating safety voice to a muted safety voice or safety silence. And I just think like as a consumer, right, I ride on the airlines. Wouldn't you want to ride on an airline where you knew this training was being done with pilots? I mean, I personally
Heck
would.
Yeah.
We have all these like safety ratings of like number one on time or we have ratings around like great to work for diversity and inclusion, right? But why don't we have one about like interpersonal skills training? And it's not just pilots. It's any environment where there's like kind of high reliability, right? This medical industry could benefit from this, like the oil industry.
EMTs, firefighters, for sure.
Totally.
Yeah. So, totally agree.
I mean, I would rather ride on an airline where I knew that the pilots were being trained in kind of enhanced crew resource management, where we're giving them the tools to create a high level of psychological safety with their whole team. So
right.
I don't know,
like maybe just the same way that I'd rather fly on an airline where I know that the two pilots up there are getting along.
Right. Yeah.
Like that, I mean, just something that simple. They can talk to each other freely. They get along. They feel safe communicating appropriately with one another. If I saw two pilots fighting or one of them being passive aggressive, like I would be like, right. I am afraid for my life right now.
Yeah. I mean, I feel like I should go back and say like on that, your listeners can Google the Alaska Airlines thing. I think it was the right decision that they went back. I mean, I wouldn't want two pilots who
agree. Yeah.
Are
it's just
very triggered
that
to be
to
flying
happen.
The airplane. Right. And it but you know, I got to be honest, I have so much data to show that that happens all the time. It doesn't always result in a news media, but it's happening all the time where some bias is impacting the psychological safety, which decreases the efficacy of these safety systems that we rely on, right? And then that reduces the overall level of safety. And so I have so much data showing this is happening.
4 hours.
I know you're going to go on a flight. I'm so sorry. It'll be fine. You have a high probability that it'll be fine.
I know. Luckily, I do not struggle with any sort of like flight anxiety. Luckily.
Good.
So Kimberly, I feel like we could talk for ages. I can't keep you any longer. A, because like you have a life, and B, because I am, like I said, going to be on a plane soon. But I do. I do like end my shows really specifically with some kind of big picture questions. And I'm always like so curious when I have guests who come on from like wildly different perspectives, different backgrounds, different like academic endeavors, how they go about answering these questions. So I know it's going to feel a little bit like a hard left, but I would love to hear I think you've heard the show before. So just as a reminder, sort of the two big things when you think about the future, the first one being what is the thing that keeps you up at night that you're most concerned about, maybe even pessimistic or cynical about. And then on the flip side, so we end on a more kind of positive note and we get our minds off of our pilots fighting in the flight deck. what is the thing that when you think about the future is most hopeful and optimistic? What is it that you're truly looking forward to?
These are good questions. Should they be like within my industry specifically?
No, not necessarily. They can be in whatever context you want. So it can be related to work. It can be personal. It can be like global, cosmic. It really doesn't matter. Just like kind of what comes to you right now in this moment.
I think sometimes I can get kind of cynical of the discussion we were talking about allyship and diversity and inclusion. And I see that a lot of people unfortunately feel threatened by this. And I get a little cynical of like, how do we navigate this zero-sum game concept? Like, how do we, because it feels threatening if we're taking power from one particular demographic and trying to say, okay, we're not actually taking your power away. We're just giving somebody else a little bit of power as well.
Right, exactly.
And so I get a little bit cynical just because I kind of hear the same things about the really like the staunch people that, you know, the 15% that say, nah, I'm good. I don't need the interpersonal skills. I hear kind of the same like zero-sum game. These like whiny, entitled. That keeps me up at night. Like, how do I reach them? Like, I just don't understand sometimes why this feels so threatening. I get the literature. I read a lot of academic literature on like, why does it feel threatening, right? And also they haven't had like a lived experience where they are being devalued based on their demographics by somebody with a higher power. So maybe they don't have that lived experience. I get it. But on a personal level, it just hurts my heart. And so that keeps me up at
night. Yeah, me too. It's like watching privilege in action is really hard. It's like painful.
Yeah, it is. And I just wish people... Yeah. So that does keep me up at night. But hopeful. So what I'm hopeful for is as we talk about these concepts, if we can model inclusivity, you know, if we're talking about these with words that aren't triggering, using framework that feels familiar and having kind of a common goal here, the common goal is that, you know, safety and flying the airplane. And I have found a lot of people coming up to me sharing their own like straight, cisgendered, white, well-seasoned in the industry men sharing their own personal stories of low psychological safety. And so it's resonating with them. And you see this like light bulb go off. And that makes me so hopeful that I can convert more people to that allyship so that we don't have 60%+ of the population saying, nah, I don't care about women. This isn't my problem, right? I'm hopeful as I talk to more and more people and they share that their personal journeys and their personal experiences that we make that transition to like a higher percentage of allyship. And that makes me hopeful.
Good. Well, gosh, this has been like super informative. Like I've learned so many things that I never even honestly I've had the privilege to never even have to think about before. And so I'm glad, like, thank you for bringing this to our attention. Thank you to the listener who recommended that you come on the show. And I have to say, good luck with your continued investigations, your continued publications, and the work that you're doing. I mean, it's so fundamentally important, and I can see it actually moving the needle within your industry. So thanks for kind of bringing us along for that ride and teaching us and letting us peek a little bit behind that big heavy door to the flight deck.
Yeah, well, and thank you for being an ally. I mean, using your platform to share the message is really important. So I appreciate you very much. And aww, the listener that recommended me. So thank you to you and your team.
Of course. And everybody listening, it's just a gratitude fest. I love it.
Everybody listening. I love it. Yay.
Thank you for coming back week after week. And I'm really looking forward to the next time that we all get together to talk nerdy.